welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later will be Peter Salmon. So how was your Thanksgiving weekend? Probably very, very different than from past years, probably smaller, fewer guests, now extended family. Maybe you did a virtual thing, though. For those of you who maybe never left home to come to campus this year, you know, it's the same old people you eat with every day. And then maybe for those of you who have, you know, moved in with roommates here in Guelph, you can do the traditional go home at Thanksgiving thing, because we were all encouraged to keep it within our immediate households this year. So, new experiences all around. Except for this show, we have turned this into a well-oiled, physically distant machine. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new independent drama, The 40-Year-Old Version, which is now streaming on Netflix. That is Version, V-E-R-S-I-O-N, and not a reference to the Steve Carell comedy of the same name that is still very popular, which is probably why they borrowed the title, save for 4 or 5 letters. Anyway, we're going to do some movie news to kick things off for this week's show. We've gone back to sort of a perilous situation for our friends in the exhibition business. What was sort of hopeful at the you know, back in August, that we were going to see movie theaters reopen and we were going to see everybody getting back to the movie theaters. Tenet was going to open. It was going to save the movie theater business. And it didn't quite turn out to be the case. Interestingly, Tenet was deposed this past weekend as the number one movie at the box office by The War with Grandpa, which is a Robert De Niro comedy, kind of like a slapstick version of Grumpy Old Men. Not that Grumpy Old Men wasn't a slapstick version of itself, but I don't really know a lot about it, but I know it was sort of the last, maybe the last big release we get in theaters for a while. I mean, there are a ton of Netflix releases coming up, and the Netflix releases get a small release in theaters, but they don't get a wide release. You know, usually they show up at like maybe some art house cinemas, you know, a couple of weeks before they appear on the streaming site. The War with Grandpa, though, is likely, likely, not for certain, but I would argue likely the last wide release movie of 2020, because right now we are down to Wonder Woman 1984, which comes out on Christmas Day, and the sequel to The Murder on the Orient Express, Death on the Nile, which comes out a couple of weeks before that. Those are pretty much the last two big movies on the release schedule for 2020. James Bond, No Time to Die, is moved to April. Dune, it was announced last week, is moving to October 2021. And then another big announcement this week was Soul, which was the next big Disney Pixar one. There was a Disney Pixar movie that came out earlier this year, Onward, and that came out a couple of weeks before lockdown, and then it quickly found its way to VOD, where you could buy it or rent it at a exclusive price, the $19.99 price. And that is what is going to happen with Soul as well, except it's going to be following the Mulan model, where it is released exclusively on Disney Plus. Mulan, you may notice, is starting to get a wider release on other VOD platforms like the Cineplex site or the regular Apple Movies site, Apple TV, the Apple TV app, and will continue to roll out like this. They're trying to milk it. I think it's currently $34.99 on the Cineplex site, but in the weeks to come, you will be able to start renting it. I know I have been saving, watching Mulan to rent. I am not quite feeling like doing a blind buy of $34.99, especially when it's only on Disney Plus. But anyway, they're exploring a similar model for Soul. And that has come with a very difficult situation for the organization that represents movie exhibitors in the UK and the EU, who have released this statement pretty much condemning Disney for opting for this. Although Disney's not the only studio that has pushed back releases this year. I guess they are the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, though. They are quite mad because movie theaters are by and large open across parts of Europe. Very much like here, where you have, you know, physical distancing, mask requirements, that sort of thing. Europe has been through, well, the worst. They are seeing flare-ups like we are seeing here, but it is more or less a steady business. It's not quite like it is in the United States, where you still have huge markets like New York and San Francisco and LA, where you still can't go to see a movie. The large markets in Europe are more or less open again. Speaking of that, though, in the United States, Regal and Cineworld, which are two of the large theater chains in the United States, have announced that they are shutting down 536 and 137 of their theaters, respectively, because they just don't have the business. And this is sort of chicken and the egg thing, where there are new movies coming out because there are enough people going to the theaters. The theaters can't stay open because they don't have any new products. Indeed, I think the number three biggest box office hit this past weekend was a re-release of Hocus Pocus. So, I mean, it's great for if you want to go to the theater and see Hocus Pocus, because you haven't been able to do that in 25 years? 30 years? 28 years? Anyway, been a while. Your kids, the kids of people who saw Hocus Pocus in the theater can now see Hocus Pocus in the theater, regardless. So it's there's this very real friction going on. People are very, very concerned. You also have the drive-ins, which have been more or less holding up the domestic box office the last several months. I mean, winter is coming. It's not going to remain feasible to go to the drive-in to watch a movie as your windshield fogs up and snows up. That's going to be very, very difficult. Although I would note the Mustang drive-in here in Guelph is still open. Typically, it does close down on Thanksgiving weekend, but this weekend, still playing movies. I think this weekend it is a double bill of Grease and Dirty Dancing. So if you like musicals and romance, that is a good time to check out the drive-in this weekend. What else we got in movie news? How about some deals? So Benedict Cumberbatch, who's played Doctor Strange in four Marvel movies so far, actually. Only one of them named Doctor Strange. He has signed up to appear in the next Spider-Man movie. This is an interesting project because you have also, they signed up Jamie Foxx to play Electro in this movie. Now, you think to yourself, well, didn't Jamie Foxx play Electro in one of those other Spider-Man movies? And you are correct. He played Electro in the 2014 Amazing Spider-Man 2. So the combination of Doctor Strange and having Jamie Foxx back as Electro has made people wonder, what the heck's going on? Are people, like, is Spider-Man, the live-action movie series, introducing the concept of the multiverse, similar to Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse? I'm going to say calm down, everybody, about that. I think it's probably irrational to expect that there's going to be a movie sometime next year where you have multiple Spider-Men in it. I mean, because first of all, it just copies what's already been done with Into the Spider-Verse. But part of it, too, is like, I remember when it was revealed that in the trailer for Spider-Man Far From Home that Mysterio was from an alternate universe, and people were like, oh my goodness, are they creating the multiverse? And then it turned out, no, it was all a con job. Spoiler alert for Spider-Man Far From Home. But, of course, the next Doctor Strange movie is called the Multiverse of Madness. So a lot of, again, it's stirring up this pot with people that it's going to be a multiverse story with multiple Spider-Men. You're going to see Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, and Tom Holland on screen together. I'm putting my foot down on that. I do not want to see for the next, like, year and a half all these think pieces about Spider-Man 3 in the multiverse, blah, 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 blah. I'm sick of it. Sick of it. It's really nice that John Watts, the director, is giving Jamie Foxx a second chance to play Electro as more of a regular comic villain and not like an over-the-top Batman and Robin-style comic villain, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago when we did the Run the Series on Spider-Man. Anyway, Jurassic World Dominion, which is the third movie in the Jurassic World series, the sixth Jurassic Park movie overall, it is currently halfway through a two-week shutdown, and they are really close to the finish line on this. They had to shut down in March because of COVID. They started filming again in July, and then they've kind of been plagued by these like various positive tests. So even though they've done a lot of the precautions, they've been doing like an NHL model where everybody's in the same hotel, and they just go from the hotel to set and the set to the hotel, but they've still had leaks. They seem to have had a pretty big outbreak on set. No numbers were provided, but it was severe enough that they shut down for 2 weeks. And I mean, this is not an isolated incident. The Batman had to shut down for 2 weeks when Robert Pattinson got COVID-19. But it's a sign that, you know, making movies is a lot more difficult than it used to be. And this is an interesting little factoid. They've been testing cast and crew 3 times a week on the Jurassic World set. They have done 27,000 tests so far during the production since July. And that has added $3 million to the budget. Probably a fraction of what Chris Pratt gets paid, but a not insignificant portion of the film's budget is going to COVID-19 testing. What else we got? Aaron Sorkin has mentioned he'd like to make a Social Network sequel. I think I would like to see that too. He cited this 2019 book called Zucked, which was written by Roger McNamee, who was an early investor in Facebook and tried to warn Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg that the Facebook was basically destroying democracy and they had to do something about it. And his warnings were, of course, ignored. So, I mean, that's not a sure thing yet. So we'll have to see what happens on that, if there's any interest in going forward with that. There is a sequel to Ready Player One, a novel called Ready Player Two. It's not a movie. I hope they don't make it a movie, because I can't abide that Ready Player One movie. I was recently listening to the We Hate Movies episode about it, and it reminded me about everything I did not like about that movie. So, Amy, maybe the books are better. I can't say. I've had Ready Player One, the book, on my shelf for years, and I still haven't read it. Elf on the Shelf. You know, that's a familiar sort of Christmas thing. Netflix is going to turn that into a franchise. They have, they're developing live action and animated Elf on the Shelf programs. Of course, Netflix is the home to a lot of popular Christmas franchises. They have Christmas Chronicles 2 coming out later this year, and they also have the Christmas Prince movies that I know are very popular, not necessarily with me. Speaking of Netflix, a Texas grand jury, you might have heard, indicted Netflix for promoting lewd behavior in underage kids, which is part of this whole cuties controversy that has even affected us here in Canada with Aaron O'Toole, the leader of the Conservative Party, demanding action on Netflix for distributing cuties. The charge is kind of lightweight, because it, like, the most severe penalty for it is a $20,000 fine. If Texas does choose to pursue it, though, I mean, Netflix will really have no choice but to fight it out in court. It probably cost them a lot more than $20,000 in legal fees, because it would be a matter of the First Amendment, and also a matter of people listening to the internet about a movie and not watching a movie and coming up with their own ideas about the movie and finding out that it's not about what they think it's about. And maybe to wrap up, we're finally gonna get a Cleopatra movie. Gal Gadot and Patty Jenkins, who worked together on the two Wonder Woman movies, are gonna make a movie about Cleopatra. And this is like something that's been worked on at various studios over the years. Like, Sony has been trying to get a Cleopatra project going for years with people like Paul Greengrass, David Fincher, and Denis Villeneuve. This is apparently a Gal Gadot joint. She put together the package. She hired a screenwriter to put together the treatment, and brings along Patty Jenkins, who is a very now famous and well established female director who directs blockbusters, starring Gal Gadot. So that will be very interesting to watch, to see if see what happens with that movie, and if it will top the previous Cleopatra movie in terms of reputation as a runaway production or box office bomb. We will have to wait and see. The complete opposite of Cleopatra is next, with the 40-year-old version. That is our review. I will get Peter on the line and be right back. You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Thought on what kind of play we want to write. Remember, if you put in nothing, it'll be nothing.
Like your career?
Remember this face? She was one of Spotlight Magazine's 30 Under 30 playwrights to watch. We watched, but where'd she go?
How are you?
Good.
Archie tells me you're teaching.
How's somebody who ain't had no real hit gonna tell me how to write a play? She ain't no Tyler Perry.
I did win a 30 Under 30 award. Yes, it was quite a couple of years ago.
What do I gotta do? Write a slave musical, an all-white play?
It rang a little inauthentic. I asked myself, did a black person really write this?
And that was a clip from the 40-year-old version. It's the new film from writer-director Rada Blank. And it stars Rada Blank, Peter Kim, Oswin Benjamin, Haskeri Velazquez, Imani Lewis, and Reed Burney. So I am now being joined on the line by Peter Salmon, the marrying man. Peter, how are you today?
Doing good. Just living life. Just still dealing with the COVID. Yeah, as we all are. I'm not super missing not going into school, but I understand why there's a lot of others that are getting a little bummed by that. If you're in the arts, I do get there's a lot more writing. I know there's a lot of people love those multiple choices, but if you're in history or English right now or something, it's a ton of writing, and that's about it. But I'm making it through.
You skirted my Marrying Man comic, because that is this week, isn't it?
Well, because you're a liar. This episode will come out, I think, Wednesday, right?
Yeah,
I'm getting married on Friday.
Yeah.
So I will be a married man, but I'm not, even when this airs, a married man yet.
Well, I did say the marrying, so it's...
Oh, did you? I heard married man. Darn right I'm a married man. I got to work on that the speech thing, doing like the classic like Christian or whatever one. Or I think there is even just like a civil... already kind of written one. I've got to make my own. So,
well, way to leave it to the last minute.
I know. Well, it's still got a week, and I've gotten some in my head.
All right, good enough. Maybe in your head, too, is some thoughts about the movie we're reviewing this week, the 40-year-old version, which way to, I guess, parlay or, you know, kind of ride the coattails of a very big, very popular movie, even if that was almost 20 years ago now. But
Was it really?
Well, it's 2004 or 5, so it's at least 15 years. So, you know, not to age people. But anyway, this was an idea you had to check out the 40-year-old version. So
no, I checked it because I thought the name, I thought it would be something like a parody of it. But, you know, it caught my interest.
So we went into this thinking it was a parody of a 16-year-old movie, but it was something very quite different. So
not another 40-year-old version.
a 40-year-old version of the 40-year-old virgin. So let's just start with what, why the movie was of interest to you. Why did you want to check it out?
Oh, well, I wanted to find a Netflix one or something like that. It had been a while since I watched a Netflix. And I find, no offense to the other streaming, that Netflix is still the best at film. And yeah, the Rattled Blank seemed interesting. I want to check it out. Yeah. Well, it also, you know, it deals a lot with Black Matters and stuff. I thought currently that is an important thing. But mainly it just caught my interest. It seemed cool. Because it's just about some, you know, a theater performer just kind of chilling around and cool New York, you know? It just kind of looks like a chill, fun ride. But with great reviews, too.
Right. I don't think Netflix would take any offense about them still being the king of streaming.
Yeah, no. I would say so.
And, you know, I would agree. I think, this is an interesting film. It comes out of Sundance. It was a winner at this year's Sundance for Best Director. So it's definitely riding those coattails. I think Sundance, one of the funds they have for funding independent movies, I think also played a role in this. So it kind of comes from the Sundance factory, shall we say. But yeah, I had heard about this movie. I didn't know too much about it. And it was really, really interesting. I mean, there's a kind of aesthetic to it where it feels like an independent movie because it's black and white, and there's not a lot of frills. It's it's got a kind of documentary style to it.
Yeah, simple plot.
Yeah, but it's very deep. It's very interesting. There are parts of it that are very funny, and it's got a great central performance from Rada Blank, as you said, who is also the writer and the director of the film too.
Yeah, everything. I think it's one of her first works too, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, as a filmmaker, yeah.
Yeah, her very first one. Yeah, like you said, not even just interesting. I thought it was great. But yeah, it was interesting. It was not what I was expecting, especially with the name. And yeah, it was just she herself was a great performer. And even though I knew it was a director starring her, it was even more self-centric, which I thought was good. She was a really fun character. Yeah, and I just thought all the acting all around was really good, too. I thought her bestie, Peter Kim, as Archie, was a lot of fun. But mainly I think what I loved about it is, like I said, it was a focus upon her. So we got some just glimpses into the other things around her and what was going on in New York. And I like that, you know, there's a lot of films where, you know, one of my worries is itself, this film would have been maybe whitewashed, right? So it dealt with solely the issues she had for her race with, you know, a lot of white characters and stuff. And there was some of that, but that was not the main focus. It was just a bunch of elements from her life, what she needs to figure out, and her, you know, I guess midlife crisis. 40, I would say, is midlife, but you know what I mean. And yeah, I thought it was a really great film, one of those kinds of works. That's another reason I picked it. I enjoy that. I enjoy more minimal plots with the focus, I guess, on the characters. And yeah, I'd say that's what we got from her, and her relationship with all the characters are interesting in their own way. Yeah, and the black and white, that was okay. I don't know how I felt about it, but with the black and white, I didn't know what the reasoning was. I thought, is this itself kind of a parody on whitewashing? Like, of course, white people are going to see this and be like, oh, so, you know, everything's black and white, you know, just a reflection upon, you know, the different race in the real life or something like that, right? Or she herself just kind of wanted to show that. But I looked it up and she just, her early films that she loved were black and white. It was the sole reason, nothing to do with race or anything. So I liked that. And that itself kind of sums up with how the film, of course, does deal with race. It's not the sole focus. It deals more with her as an individual. And I liked that. I thought it was something needed.
I think the purpose of the black and white, I think there are a couple of ways you can read into it. Because I was curious about that creative choice too. I think it plays into, I guess, the kind of film that Rada Blank is trying to make here, which is something that's very kind of Woody Allen or John Cassavetes, but at the same time, it's about the black experience and the black woman experience. But it's one of these, like, New York movies. I mean, it would not be, I think, out of the realm of inappropriateness to say, like, you could probably put this in, like, a film festival of, like, you could probably put the 40-year-old version in like, a film festival of, like, New York movies. You could probably sandwich it between, like, a couple of Woody Allen movies, like Annie Hall.
Yeah.
And it just kind of flows. You would still kind of get that vibe of the we're so neurotic in New York experience, but it because it is the voice of a black woman, it has a completely different tone and feel to it as well.
Yeah, I actually I enjoyed its usage, or at least I found it less pretentious than, say, recent works like Frances Ha or Nebraska. Like, I love them, but there was less of a reasoning. Like, in this, like I said, it was just she liked the filmmakers, but there is a lot of more analyzing that can be done with black and white in this. Whereas those other ones, it's more just directly homage, or I don't know, just kind of pretentious. I love Frances Ha, and, you know, Nebraska's a film and such, but I thought the black and white worked better for this.
Right. Black and white can feel pretentious, but because of what Rada Blank said, and I think also the black and white is very reflective of the character too.
Exactly. I don't know if that was her main intent, but that is something, yeah, that stood out to me too.
I'm not sure if it's her intent, but it just, you know, because she's seeing things in very black and white terms, both racially.
Or the others are viewing black and white as such a vast separation, which is even more visually, you know, in black and white, right?
Right, and you can almost take it a step further, too, that, you know, it's about the grayness. I mean, so much of this is about compromise and, you know, how much you bend in order to be a success, or even to, like, just salvage a bit of your vision, because the main thrust of this is that she's written this play about Harlem being gentrified, and she's gone out of her way to make it or to avoid a lot of the traps and the stereotypes. Poverty porn is a term she throws around, but she doesn't want it to be poverty porn. She doesn't want it to be, you know, about white saviors or getting white people to believe the black experience. She just wanted to present it as is. And as the movie goes on, she's continually to push to, you know, compromise the vision, compromise it, and to make it more palatable to a white audience too. And, you know, she gets that from her friend Archie too, who's like, you know, there's a line in it where he says, oh, the next one will be better. And she's like, what does that mean? And I mean, I think it's easy to understand the meaning. Is like, his point is, you do this one, you take all the notes, you make this into a success, and then you will have the creative freedom the next time out.
When if it fails next time, you're at least a bit more used to it, right?
Well, this is it, too.
That's kind of how I viewed it, too.
And I would also argue that I think that is not the experience of a lot of black artists and black filmmakers, or, you know, even women filmmakers. If you think about Catherine Bigelow, and, you know, she's made two films since Zero Dark Thirty. Not Zero Dark Thirty, because that was one of the films. But since Hurt Locker, which was 11 years ago?
Yeah.
You would think that winning the Academy Award for Best Director would open up all kinds of doors for you. But, you know, there she stands, like, Academy Award winner Catherine Bigelow, history-making director Catherine Bigelow, has only made two films in the last 11 years.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and, you know, so implicit in that, too, the line that, you know, the next one will be better. It's like, yeah, if there is a next one, because in a lot of cases, for black directors, women directors, any, you know, director, any minority person, you only get one shot to make an impression, or, you know, and then spend, maybe they're going back to, you know, the struggle, and it's very hard to break out of those pigeonholes that, you know, once you're kind of settled in. I'm sure Catherine Bigelow has all kinds of offers to make movies like The Hurt Locker, you know, more war Hurt Locker 2. or, you know, like action-y war type stuff. Hurt Lockers. You know, that kind of action-y war type stuff, but, you know, that's maybe not something she wants to do.
No, she doesn't have as much free control. Right. Even more so for black women or women, but directors, black directors too, like males, like Steve McQueen has way less of he's been doing okay, but way less of release ratio in comparison to, you know, other very famous white directors like Todd Phillips or something, or right. You know, just like Steven Spielberg. But even so, with the women like you're talking about, but it's just, yeah, it's just an issue all around.
But Steve McQueen's a great example, because he makes 12 Years a Slave, and it's a rave. It gets Oscar nominations. It makes Critic Circles nominations. It's what everybody wants to talk about. And then after that, he makes Widows, which is, I think, a great movie. But it's not, it doesn't fall into any of those easy stereotypes of, you know, poverty porn, gangsters, titrices about, you know, slavery or anything like that. It's just a really great, solid kind of Shane Black action film that stars a predominantly black female cast.
Yes.
And you just can't, and you know, the audience just didn't show up for that one because it doesn't fit one of these, like, areas that, yeah, one of these, like, acceptable areas where black storytellers can, are allowed to comment.
Yeah. And, yeah, I just, at the whitewashing, I just really loved how it was displayed in the film. More so in the play she was making, right? I thought that was really, really cool. I thought also just what we were talking about, what women have to deal with and stuff, I thought it was a good look into, you know, we know, like, Me Too, we know all the stuff going on, you know, in Hollywood and TV, but there's not as much to talk about in theater. So it was a nice scene. There's a lot of things going on there. And sorry, not just the women. It actually seemed in theater. It was more Archie that had to go about doing some things to get what he wanted. Right. But I thought that was fun. But like I said, that was just a little peek into that, because it's her film. That was cool. That little, and we didn't talk about the kids yet, but I thought the kids, it was my favorite of the little kind of stories going on. I thought it was fun. And one thing they didn't do, maybe I just misheard, I don't think for the school they used like inner city or any like ghetto or any kind of term like that, other than, like you said, when she was describing how bad they are. And I like that, because I think that's more, you know, in a whitewashed thing, there'd be, the focus would have become on that being an inner city or just like an underpaid public school in Harlem, right? But no, the focus was just on those kids, right? You didn't even hear the name of the school or whatever. So I thought that was really cool. And the kids also, I won't spoil anything, but there's an interesting storyline that goes on. Interesting is not the right word. There's one I really like. But I guess a little interesting. It surprised me off guard a pinch. Just because the one character is hatred. But yeah, there's some stuff going on with the kids too. They're fun little own stories. I think the kids too are one of the best displays for how, I'd say this was more of a drama, but there's definitely some comedic elements. Like, I got a couple laughs. My favorite was the two boys in the group, the play that they came about with, which had something to do with, like, a black guy finding his first white vagina and it changing everything in the world. It was very interesting. And I did not appreciate their point of view of their story, but then Rada changed their point of view into something a bit more of a cool comment upon race. That was fun. That was fun. Things like that.
That was interesting. Having once sort of workshopped a group of young people in a filmmaking class myself, I can relate to the experience of trying to rally and focus the idea making factory of young people. But I mean, there's a commentary in there too that, you know, I guess it's about like sort of the insular nature of theater, and we're going to make a play, but it has to be filled with symbolism, and it has to have ideas about, you know, approaching different aspects of society, about, you know, gender relationships and racialized relationships, and we're trying to say like three different things in one metaphor, and none of it makes sense because we are trying so hard to be we're trying so hard to play like 5D chess with all this that we're not really saying anything coherent at all. But I mean, it was all in good fun too.
Yeah, exactly, and
those young actors were really, really good too. I mean, that was where some of the prime comedy was in the movie.
Yeah, for sure. I thought all acting was great. I thought the main male character, or I guess love interest, I'd say Alex was in it, Archie was in it more, but Oswin Benjamin as D was pretty cool too. He was a fun guy. He was interesting. I think she definitely, the director of the film, Rada, she definitely has some interest in current hip hop, because production has become almost more of a focus than the actual rapper, right? Like, mm-hmm. The 21 Savage Metro Boomin that came out the other day, it's gotten critical acclaim, but every article, it's like, phenomenal album, mainly because of producer Metro Boomin, you know what I mean? So I thought it was cool that there was a producer as a main character in this one, and he was just a fun dude. He didn't talk much, he enjoyed that marijuana, and yeah, he was a very reserved person, but he was also very, very nice, very warm-hearted at the same time. So I thought he was cool. And especially I enjoyed how, I think we mentioned a bit with Tenet, they're breaking some of the barriers of who the male interest to the woman is, right? I enjoyed just in Tenet her being, you know, taller than everybody. But in this one, I enjoyed the guy's the young one, right? That's a lot more of a rarity, and I enjoyed that. Yeah, he's literally exactly my age too, and I'm like, yeah, there's no issue with that. So anybody saying 40, 20, that's fine.
Right.
And it was fun. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It was I did enjoy Oswin Benjamin too. The movie's really good with that, playing against your, you know, expectations too, and you know,
but, he, theater world and the hip hop world too.
Right, and you know, she kind of goes to visit his apartment / studio, and you know, he works for weed, and immediately you're sort of painted into certain ideas about who he is and why he's doing what he does, and it's really interesting how D doesn't really say too much.
Like, no, he doesn't have a lot of
dialogue. So he's kind of like a really introspective type. But so like when he does talk, he also has like a very quiet voice too. So
it's very sweet.
So when he talks, you really pay attention, and what he's like, you know, first of all, he has a romantic interest in Radha, but he also has this musical interest in Radha, and you see him kind of suffering through all these other people who come to his apartment to record and collaborate with him, and they, I mean, he basically says, like, they have nothing to say, and you have so much to say, but you are out here in the world trying to gain the approval and the artistic approval of all these, you know, white people at the theater end of town, as opposed to, you know, these places here in Harlem where you have people from racialized communities talking about their experiences using hip hop as a way to express themselves, and, you know, saying things that white people will probably never hear, because there are these levels of sanitation between what's going on in these sort of rap battles and where people go to hear quote unquote black voices, which, as we see through the playwriting process, do become quite sanitized. But of course, that's a lot of words, and there really is an economy of dialogue with D that is really interesting, that he's able to say so much without really saying much.
Yeah, and their scene together in the bed and the kind of conversation they have is really nice. Really, a lot of deep stuff, but also just good to see them together. Seeing Radha Blank is just, you know, a regular human being.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that there are scenes in the movie where she falls into her own preconceived notions, because there's this homeless guy who lives across the street from her who's always kind of like haranguing her about, you know, not going out on dates or trying to get her plays published or what. And she, on the night of the premiere of Harlem Ave, the play she wrote, she takes a sandwich over to him, and, you know, they start talking, and he eventually says something to the effect of, you know, did you really think you were going to bring a sandwich over to me and you were going to get some sort of magic wisdom from this homeless person? And then she makes the point, like, oh yeah, I guess you're right. And then he, I love this when he says, like, next time put mayonnaise on both.
Yeah, I loved it.
Which is a great note.
Yeah, it was. Well, and like I said, that's just an example of how there's kind of little other stories going on, just so you get a wide look into her life and the world she lives in.
Yeah.
But like I said earlier, it did that well, but it's maintain more of a grand focus on her as an individual.
Yeah, it's important to note, I think, I probably haven't thought about it much myself, but, you know, just the sheer idea of, like, producing art that is about black people who are happy and just kind of living their lives, and, you know, maybe they have some struggles, but, you know, you don't really see, you know, to just pull an idea out of my hat, but, you know, you don't really see the black version of Parenthood too much, you know, where it's like, here we are just living our lives, and sometimes we have struggles, sometimes grandma gets cancer, and sometimes, you know, the teen son gets in a car accident, and, you know, but otherwise, it's just about living life and finding true love and being a good, good, honest family to one another and loving one another. That is, it has been known to happen. There are certainly shows, Black-ish is sort of one I think about, where it is kind of very much like, here's just a family, they just happen to be black. But
The show Black-ish.
The okay. Show Black-ish, yeah.
You're giving a really awful description of the show. But I've heard that one. It's apparently great.
But I've seen it a couple of times. But, you know, it's weird, because not the idea is weird, but it's weird to actually focus on something like that, because it seems like white people can only process black stories through black trauma. That is poverty, whether that's slavery, whether it's, you know, the socioeconomic depression that leads to gang activity or drug use or whatever. Mm-hmm. But to actually see it laid out in watching the development of this play, which Rada explains at the beginning, kind of very straightforward. It's like, oh, it's about this young black couple who inherit the store of his parents, this Harlem store, this kind of general store in Delhi kind of deal. And they're just trying to make a go of it while gentrification is going on around them. And then this producer comes in and goes, no, 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 it's not enough just to say gentrification. We have to actually personify it. And how do you personify gentrification? You put in a couple of white people. Yep. And then, I mean, that starts it on a course of, like, changing the taste and the flavor of the movie, which is a black story about a black experience in a black part of New York, and then making it palatable to white people. And at the same time, sort of subtextually reminding you that telling white people stories, you don't have to change it to make it palatable to the black audience. Nobody's sitting there in a production meeting going, are the black people in the audience going to get this story? That is a conversation that never happens.
Yeah. Well, and that should be, well, I don't know if that should be more thin or more of a thin or just the white one gotten rid of. But yeah, I think it's an unfair, when it comes to the population that gets a focus for the making of media, I don't think it's fair. And yeah, she makes a comment upon that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And it's just, it's not preachy either. I hope that's not coming, like, this is a very preachy kind of movie.
No, that was the main thing. Like, she herself was against all that preachy things, right? Like, that's what her play was making fun of. So that's why, right, I'm saying I really liked how there was a lot of matters that didn't really have to do with race, just how that's how a black person deals with that, right? So I liked that. Like you said, it the whole film, yeah, of course it dealt with black issues, but not with the main focus being on a black issue.
Right. I think it has to do with I think of the struggles of a lot of artists, like how much do you compromise your vision in order to get something made? It just so happens that this is like the unique experience of a black storyteller, a black female storyteller, and I mean that is still a very underrepresented group, both sort of artistically, whether that is, you know, in plays or cinematically even. It was nice to see, and it was nice to kind of like understand the barriers, and I would say that they're not like, I think the producer means well, and the white female director who makes the play, that like everybody means well, but it goes to show you, just, you know, people don't, or these people like need to kind of get out of their own way to sort of let people like Rada Blank tell their own stories. And I think that's sort of the inherent message of this. It's like, look, white people, you mean well. We appreciate all the efforts on our behalf, but like, just honestly, just let us tell our stories.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I think it added some realism to that. Going off what you were saying, a lot of the other characters had stories, but some of them weren't concluded. And that's because, like I said, it was a film for Rada. Film for Rada, by Rada. Because Peter Kim, who plays Archie, he loses, like, his love, right? And that's not really dived into at all later. The one kid kind of relationship going on, you never see it fully come together or anything, you know? You just see kind of the glimpses of her life, which I think made it seem more real.
Well, the story's all about, like, pointing out the things that sort of go unsaid.
And yeah, I mean, when I said the main focus wasn't race, I meant like that. I meant there's a lot of other elements that don't have to do with that.
Right, because, I mean, Archie's, you know, the fact that his boyfriend left him, it very much has to do with work, you know, he was putting work above his relationship, and he feels that's not the case, but I mean, it's always in the eye of the beholder. But I mean, it was also something that he doesn't bring up to his friend at all, and she finds out in the course of, like, you know, staying at his place, she's like, oh, where's your boyfriend? And he's like, oh, yeah, we kind of broke up.
Yeah.
And it's just like, really? We don't mention that at all to our friend before she comes over and stays at our house? But, and then with the two young people as well, I like that. It was about the one girl, Elaine, she had romantic feelings about this other girl she gets into a fight in class with, and Rada makes the point, it's like, you know, we both know what this is about, even if you don't say it.
That was one of the best beats in the film.
It says something about, you know, trying not to leave things unsaid, and the real danger and the real source of a lot of this friction is just sort of leaving stuff on the field and you know, not addressing directly the things we feel and the things we want to say. And I mean, it's kind of a warning in that way too. It's like, you know, now's the time to like get all of this out, hash all this out, even if it's on screen. And I think that that is another one of the messages that Rada Blank is sending out.
Oh yeah, of course. The message, even though it does have to do with her middle age, I enjoyed that didn't become the main focus, like the absolute main focus. I am glad we didn't even really get to see her 40th, and I'm glad there wasn't, you know, her going to Indigo or whatever they call it in the States and buying some 4-year-old help book, you know, or something like that. I like
Barnes.
I like
Barnes and Noble is the American equivalent of Barnes Indigo chapters.
Yeah, so I'm glad about that.
No, I like that too, because I mean, the idea of like 40 being like the make or break moment is so artificial too. And so to just sort of put that in context, it's like, this isn't about you turning 40. It's about this artificial deadline you've set up for yourself to make yourself something, as opposed to just trying to be the best possible person you could be and trying to make yourself happy. And, you know, that's pretty much what the movie's about in a nutshell.
Yeah, and it, like I said, we'd already talked about it. It just dives in kind of a bunch of other pockets just to add more depth to her and you really get in her as a character. One that was just really kind of behind the scenes kind of plot going on the whole film is her mother's death. And it's very, you know, only mentioned a few times, but a very huge reasoning for all of her emotions and what's going on. And I thought that was, I thought that was really cool. It also dealt with her relationship with her brother, which kind of showed, like, even if it's not the main issue, we've always got a lot of other little issues going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also one of the only things I think did kind of dive deeper into middle age, where your parents, unfortunately, you know. So I thought that was a nice another glimpse into her life, just to add that realism to her.
Mm-hmm.
The mom thing was really cool. And like I said, even though kind of a subplot, you could say the mom is the reasoning for all the issues that she's dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's also, it was interesting that the one scene where she finally does go to her mother's apartment and it's like, You think you have sort of let yourself down because you have not accomplished A, B, and C. It's like, well, mom was doing all this stuff while, you know, raising a family, being an artist, being a teacher. You can, you know, it's not about all about being the one big thing. You can do a bunch of little things and still have a substantively good life. It's not about proving yourself to the big bads out there.
Yeah, well, he commented like that it, yes, the mom too was an artist and loved it, but it was for her family first. Mm. And I think that in the film made Rada maybe sort of realize that herself.
Mm-hmm.
Or that, you know, she could still have the life she wants without being, you know, some A-list theater playwright. And that kind of, her thought on that regards kind of goes well with the ending and what she decides, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, so that's why I said it was a small little plot, but it actually had like a big amount to do with a lot of the meanings in the film that she was trying to get across. I could see why there was none better than this one when it comes to the... You said it... Which one did you say it won? Best
director.
Yeah, best director. Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah, it was pretty solid. There's no really flaws that I can think of. I know it's boring. I'm sorry to the listeners. We'll try and find a crap film next, but... Yeah, this one was... It was real solid work. Only 2 hours, too, so you can pump through it.
What a promise. We'll find a crap film next.
Yeah, we'll try.
All right, Peter. If people want to recommend some crap films or send you good wishes for your wedding, how can people find you on the internet?
Same old, Mr. Tarak, YouTube, and good old Twitter.
And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Speaking of the Spotify, you can find a playlist of all the music you hear on End Credits. Just go to your Spotify app and search for End Credits on CFRU. You can find us on social media, Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. Find my News and Politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. And you can find my writings about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.